pleasure to be here at UC Davis today. I will talk about searches for new physics in BDKs. For the students in the audience, and I don't know how many students are there, but yeah, a couple at least. Let me, first of all, very briefly mention what I mean by new physics, although some of the students that I see here are theorists, so they shouldn't need this introduction. Well, we are all familiar with the Standard Model, and we know that the Standard Model has been around for a quite long time. In its first 35 years of life, the Standard Model has been very successful, maybe even too successful. There are good reasons to believe that the Standard Model is not a complete theory, but that there is some extension of the Standard Model out there. Many extensions have been proposed by our colleagues theorists, some of whom in this room. These extensions might be in the form of SUSY, extra dimensions, technical, or you name it. All of these extensions of the Standard Model are what I will collectively call new physics in this talk. As an experimentalist, what I'm interested in doing is to actually go and look for direct evidence of new physics. And there are two ways in which one experimentalist can look for new physics. The first one is the direct searches of new particles predicted by new physics. And these searches are now taking place at the Tevatron these days and will soon move to the LHC. But there is another set of measurements that one can do in order to look for new physics in some more indirect ways. And these are searches that are as promising as the direct searches. Among the various possibilities, what I'm interested in are studies that have to do with the study of CP violation of B mesons and the study of rare B mesons. And these are the studies that I will talk about in this talk. This is the outline of the presentation. I think I don't need this. So here's the outline of the presentation. I will start by discussing what are the constraints that we can get on new physics by studying CP violation. I will start with a brief introduction that will mention how CP violation comes in the Standard Model, and discuss why we should expect to see new physics in the study of CP violation. Then I will discuss the beauty of the unitarity triangle, and I will try to convince you that by measuring precisely sides and angles of this triangle, we will have a good chance to look, at least, for new physics. In particular, in the second part of my talk, I will discuss a new measurement of one of the sides of the unitarity triangle that one can measure at the B factories by studying the decays of a B meson into a rho and a photon. And this is a paper that was recently accepted by PRL, and by recently I mean yesterday, so new stuff. Towards the end of my talk, I will try to convince you that not only we can look for new physics in CP violation, but we can also look at new physics in different ways at the B factories. And I will bring up a couple of examples, studies of tau nu decays and study of B2S gamma. Finally, I will summarize and conclude. Now, since most of my talk has to do with the CP violation, then let me introduce what CP is. So CP is a discrete symmetry of nature that is made of the product of two ingredients. C, the charge conjugation, which is the transformation that sends a particle into the corresponding antiparticle, and P, the parity, which is a transformation which inverts the space coordinates. There are a number of reasons that make the study of CP violation very interesting. First of all, we're all familiar with the famous paper that Andrei Sakharov published in 1967. And in that paper, Sakharov proved that CP violation is one of the three ingredients that you need in order to be able to explain a matter-dominated universe. Second, studies of CP violation allow us to measure two parameters of the Standard Model, the parameters rho and eta, that I will define in a couple of slides. And third, and to me most interesting, the study of CP violation may hold the key to uncover the first signs of new physics. Why? Well, you remember the new physics models that we mentioned in the previous page. Well, many of these models have a number of additional phases on top of the one phase predicted by the Standard Model that would alter the predictions of the Standard Model in CP violation land. In particular, the minimum supersymmetric Standard Model has something like 43 new phases in addition to the one predicted by the Standard Model. So it's not crazy at all to look for new physics in the study of CP violation. But in order to describe CP violation, in order to explain CP violation, we don't really have to go to new physics, because CP violation is explained in the standard model. Although that was not always the case. When CP violation was discovered in 1964 by Fitch and Cronin in their study of K-long decays, that came as a complete surprise. It took the theorists almost 10 years to be able to describe CP violation in what we call today the standard model of particle physics. Of course, in 1964, there was no standard model of particle physics, just extrapolate from there. It was 1973 when Kobayashi and Maskawa came up with their mechanism, the so-called Kabibo-Kobayashi-Maskawa mechanism. According to their mechanism, CP violation originates in the standard model from a complex phase, this parameter eta, in the quark mixing matrix. Here I wrote down the quark mixing matrix and I expanded it in the so-called Wolfenstein parameterization, in which the matrix can be described in terms of four parameters. The parameter lambda is the sine of the Kabibo angle. A is another parameter. These two parameters have been very well measured for a long time, so we really know them very well. In addition to these two parameters, there are two more parameters, rho and eta. Those are the two parameters that have to do with CP violation, in particular eta. Without eta, we wouldn't have CP violation in the standard model. But these two parameters were very poorly known until recently. Now, how well does this model work in terms of explaining CP violation? Well, the short answer to this question is it works very well for many different reasons. First of all, it provides us with an elegant and simple explanation of CP violation in the framework of the standard model that we all love. Second, it's very predictive, and this has to do with the fact that there is only one CP violating phase in the standard model, so it's not that hard to make predictions at that point. And third, and most important, this explanation seems to accommodate all of the experimental results that we accumulated so far in CP violation land in terms of measurements in the lab, both in the Kaon system and in the B system. But there could be more to this picture. Remember all the new physics models that we mentioned? Well, as we said, they bring in several additional CP violating phases. So the idea is to use this predictive power of the CKM method and to use this predictive power in terms of going beyond the standard model and use measurements of CP violation to test models beyond the standard model. How do we do this? Well, the idea is to measure CP violation in channels that are theoretically very well understood in the framework of the standard model, and then look for deviations with respect to the standard model expectations. Now, in order to be able to do this, we need to be able to put together a huge amount of experimental information in some coherent way, and to compare this, hopefully in an easy way, with the theoretical expectations. So we need a framework in order to be able to do this effectively. And the framework is provided by the so-called unitarity triangle. The beauty of the unitarity triangle is that it is able to convert a pretty complicated physics problem into a trivial geometry problem that, you know, a sixth grader probably could understand. So the whole point here is to understand what the unitarity triangle is all about. Well, let me try to explain this. Let's go back to the CKM matrix. Here's the CKM matrix. If we want probability to be conserved, then this matrix has to be a unitary matrix, which means that V dagger V has to be equal to 1. This implies 6 unitarity conditions that relate to the 9 elements that form this matrix. One of these conditions that I wrote down here is of particular interest. Let's look at it. This is the condition that relates the elements in the first and in the third column. If we look at this expression, this is nothing but the sum of 3 complex numbers that add up to 0. So we can think of this as a triangle in the complex plane. If we divide the 3 elements of this sum by the second element here, what we end up with is a triangle that looks like this. And this is what we call the unitarity triangle. What is special about this triangle is that all the sides of the triangle and all the angles of the triangle can be measured experimentally. And this is due to the fact that the sides of the triangle are all of the same order of magnitude. They are all of order 1. So this makes the triangle not flat, so we can measure both sides and angles, which is not true for other triangles, for example. And the other interesting thing, of course, is that all of these quantities can be measured experimentally in the study of BDKs. Since we're going to use this triangle quite a bit in this talk, let me spend a couple of more minutes trying to look at the subtleties of it. So this is a triangle with a base that is normalized to 1. This means that in order to fully constrain this triangle, all we have to do is to measure two quantities. For example, we could measure the two sides of the triangle, right? This would fully determine the apex of the triangle. This would perfectly measure rho and eta if we can measure this two quantity with an infinite precision. But this is all standard model. We're not going beyond the standard model, even if the precision on these two measurements is infinite. If we want to go beyond the standard model, then we have to add measurements to this. And for example, measure the two sides and one of the angles, just to mention one example, in order to over-constrain this triangle. So please notice that redundancy is not a luxury in these kind of experiments. It's what allows us to do our physics. It's what allows us to test the standard model and look for new physics. So there are many ways in which we can look for new physics with this triangle. The first and most obvious way is to compare the measurement of the sides with the measurement of the angles. The second way that we could use is to measure one angle, for example, this angle here, in different ways that have different sensitivities to new physics. Any discrepancy would be a sign of new physics. Third and most recent, what we could do is to measure one side of the triangle in different modes that again have different sensitivity to new physics. Again, any discrepancy would be a sign that something very interesting is going on. Well, I hope that by now I convinced you that it's important to measure very precisely both sides and angles of this triangle. So the question is, how do we do this experimentally? I already mentioned before that all of these quantities can be accessed by studying BDKs. And there are two sets of experiments that allow us to perform this sort of measurements. First of all, the B-factories. There are two B-factories in the world, one at SLAC and one at KK. These are experiments that collide electrons and positrons at about 10 GeV. At 10 GeV, we form a resonance called the Y4S that always decays into a B and an anti-B. So in the final state, all what we have is a B and an anti-B, in total 10 charged particles on average. So these are really clean final states. The other set of experiments that have been contributing to the measurement of this triangle are the two experiments at the Tevatron, D0 and CDF. And I'm sure that here at Davis you have heard a lot about both experiments. So those are PP bar experiments that collide at a center of mass of about 2 TeV. You don't do B physics here, so let me stress what are the advantages of this kind of experiment. Okay, let me start from a disadvantage or a challenge, let's put it that way. When you're running at these kind of energies, you're not going to end up with 10 particles in the final state. You end up with probably a couple, one or two orders of magnitude more particles in the final state. So finding the particles coming from your BDKs is not going to be very easy. Another challenge that you have to face at the Tevatron is that the cross-section for BB bar is suppressed by something like 3 orders of magnitude compared to the inelastic cross-section. So you have to go and pick those B events. That means you have to build triggers that are able to record these events. So this is another non-trivial thing to do. This is that picking BB bar events is trivial at the B factories because 1 every 4 hadronic events is a BB bar event at the B factory. So all what you do is you run with totally open triggers, and you will collect them all. So at this point, you would think that the B factories have a clear advantage here. Well, there's more to the picture. Luminosity. The B factories have been running very well. Both experiments now take data routinely at an instantaneous luminosity of the order of 10 to the 34. And overall, if you sum the statistics by the two experiments, we integrated more than 1 inverse Hadamard. So that's a good thing. What happens at the Tevatron, the luminosities are of the order of 10 to the 32. At least last time I checked, they were of the order of 10 to the 32. So you would think that there are 2 orders of magnitude. Well, that's not quite the case, because at the Tevatron, you have much higher cross-sections. So at the end, the rates that you end up with, and this is what matters for physics, are comparable to the rates that you get at the B-factory. So I would put, in terms of luminosity, those two experiments on the same footing. Last but not least, you have to consider what kind of particles you produce in the final state. At the B factories, what we do is to produce B0 and charged Bs with a pretty modest boost of the order of 0.5. This is good enough to allow us to do time dependent CP violation measurements, but if you want to do something a little more demanding than just this, it could not be enough. At the Tevatron, instead, on top of B0 and B+, they also produce B sub S, lambda B, B sub C, you name it. They have enough energy to produce any B hadron. And the other good thing is that their boost is much higher than ours. And this is crucial if you're in the business, for example, of measuring time-dependent B sub S mixing. So at this point, you can conclude that this last point makes the B physics program at the Tevatron worthwhile. So the two sets of experiments are complementary, and they're both necessary in order to complete the measurements of the unitarity triangle. Unfortunately, I don't have any time to go into the details, neither of the accelerator or the detectors, because I really want to focus on physics since we have so many results that I would like to discuss. So let me go back to the year 1999, which is the year when the B factories started taking data. How much did we know about the unitarity triangle at that point in time? Well, this is a picture that should summarize that. This is the rho gamma plane, and the region that you see here in black is the region that at the time was allowed for the apex of the unitarity triangle. So these constraints on the apex of the triangle were coming from two sets of measurements. The measurement of this side that was coming from the study of semi-leptonic BDKs that at the time was being performed at Clio and LAP mainly, and this other side that was coming from precise measurements of B sub D mixing at the Z pole experiment and also at Clio, and another measurement, this one, a limit on the B sub S mixing frequency that was coming from SLD and LAP as well. So there was some knowledge of where the triangle apex had to be, but again, this was just coming from the measurement of the two sides. And remember, when we measure the two sides, even if we did with precision, all we do is to measure the two parameters of the standard model rho and eta. So there was no constraint on new physics. So the first thing that the B factories added to this picture was one additional quantity, that is the measurement of one of the angles. So how do we measure the angles at the B factory? Well, here is the idea. We measure a quantity called the time-dependent CP asymmetry. This is defined as the number of B0 bar that after a time t decays into a final state f, which is a CP eigenstate, minus the number of B0s instead of B0 bar that after the same time t decay into the same final state, which is a CP eigenstate again, divided by the sum of these two quantities. How do we get this measurement experimentally? Well, here is the trick. We collide electrons and positrons at 10 GeV. At this energy, we produce an epsilon for S, and we are looking for decays of the epsilon for S into a B0 and a B0 bar. We reconstruct one of these Bs into an exclusive CP final state, which brings in this FCP, this formula. The other B can decay into whatever it wants. The important is that in the final state, there will be something, for example, a high momentum electron, that will allow us to understand what was the flavor of this other B at the decay time. Once we tag the flavor of this B at this point in time, then we know what was the flavor of this other B at the same point in time. Why? Well, because the two Bs coming from the decay of an epsilon for S have been produced coherently. So they will mix, but their mixing will be coherent. So when one is a B0, the other one is a B0 bar, and vice versa, until the first one decays. So if this one was tagged as a B0 bar, we know this guy is a B0 at time that we call t equals 0. That's the time at which we start our chronometer to measure the time t in this equation. How do we measure the time t? Well, the beams of the B factories are asymmetric. The electron beam is something like three times more energetic than the positron beam. These two Bs would be produced parallel to the direction of the electrons. This is what we call our Z direction. This means that the displacement that we call the delta Z between these two decay vertices is directly proportional to the time in between the two decays, and the proportionality constant is nothing but the boost of the B. So simple relativity will allow us to measure the time t. That is the last ingredient that we need in order to get to this equation. So from the experimental point of view, this measurement is conceptually not very complicated. But how is the measurement of the time-dependent CP asymmetry related to the angles of the triangle? Well, let's try to find out. First of all, what we're doing in our experiment is to look for the case of a B meson into a CP final state. There are two ways in which you can get there. First, you can have the B0 decaying directly to a CP final state through an amplitude that we will call A. Or you can have the B0 first mixing into a B0 bar and then decay into the CP final state through an amplitude that I will call A bar. Now, I don't want to go into too many details, so I skipped the math in this slide, but you can prove that when you have only one diagram contributing, by one diagram I mean one Feynman diagram contributing to the final state, then you can prove that the time-dependent CP asymmetry can be written as the product of two quantities. One amplitude, that I will call imaginary part of a parameter lambda, and a sinusoidal oscillation that depends on delta m, where delta m is the difference in mass between the two neutral beam mass Huygens states here. The parameter lambda that I mentioned here can be written as the product of two terms, a ratio of q over p, where q and p are two complex coefficients that relate the mass eigenstates with the flavor eigenstates for the neutral B, and the ratio of the amplitudes A bar and A, which are the two amplitudes that I mentioned here. Okay? Now, this is a simple oscillatory term, so all we have to do is to see how the imaginary part of lambda is related to the angles of the triangle. In order to find that out, we have to make an explicit assumption on the final state that we're looking at, because different final states are sensitive to different angles of the triangle. And the example that I picked here is the classic example for this kind of physics, the decay of a B0 into a J psi and a K0. This is the so-called golden mode for the measurement of CP violation for a number of reasons. First of all, theoretically, this decay is very well understood. This is the diagram that dominates this decay. Experimentally, this measurement is extremely clean, and I will prove that in a minute. And finally, from the experimental point of view, again, this final state is blessed by a relatively large branching fraction of the order of 10 to the minus 4, which in absolute standards is not a very large branching fraction, but if you're in the business of measuring CP violation, this is a pretty good starting point. Now, for this final state, you can calculate the parameter lambda. Remember, lambda was given by the ratio of these amplitudes here as the product of three different terms. The first terms come from the fact that the B0 can mix in the initial state. The second term comes from this Feynman diagram. You see here VCB and VCS appearing. And the third term comes from the K0 that can mix in the final state. You do a little bit of algebra, and you can convince yourself that lambda is directly related to the angle beta, where beta is this angle of the unitarity triangle. So the imaginary part of lambda, which was the amplitude of your time-dependent CP asymmetry, is nothing but sine to beta, where beta is this angle here. Now, remember that I told you that this final state is extremely clean from the experimental point of view. Well, let me show you some data to prove that statement. Here is the invariant mass of the B0 that we reconstruct in J psi K short. As you can see, well, this is data, by the way, not Monte Carlo. As you can see, we have a little tiny bit of background here, but you almost need a magnifying lens in order to be able to see. So this is a beautifully clean sample.